I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gail Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There are going to be some big changes in the U.S. House in January. The Democrats have regained control of the chamber, and their majority seems to be growing every day as new races are decided in their favor. One big decision for Congressman Peter Welch is, who will he support as the next Speaker of the House? Will he back Nancy Pelosi? At this time, he says, he's undecided.
Whoever the leader is, we have to make concrete steps towards decentralization of power, more power in the committees, and number two, a more open process where amendments are allowed, including offered by the minority. I want to make certain that that is a consensus among the Democratic caucus.
What will serving in the majority party mean for Representative Peter Welch? He has a fair amount of seniority. Will he be involved in leadership positions? Today on Vermont Edition, we'll discuss these and many other issues with our guest, Congressman Peter Welch. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Great to have you here. Congressman, we have a very interesting situation concerning the Speaker's race in Congress. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said yesterday she has the votes needed to be elected Speaker in January. However, some new members who pledged not to support her during their campaigns say they have the votes to block her nomination. So who's right?
Well, there's no other person declared to be running right now. So Nancy Pelosi is the only announced candidate in that race. So if the folks who have pledged not to vote for her haven't come forward with the candidate yet. So that's still up in the air. But I want to give a little context here. In the past, the election of the Democratic and Republican leader occurred immediately after the general election. And, in fact, the Republicans had their election of Kevin McCarthy this week. I was among a group of Democrats who argued successfully that we should postpone our leadership race until at least several weeks after the election to give us, when we return to Washington, and we're here now, the opportunity to make an argument about what rule changes we need in order to have a more open Congress. And in fact, this time is being used quite productively because the big issue for me is more how we're led versus who leads us. The last Congress was very closed. Bills were written in secret, like the repeal of the health care bill written in the Speaker's office, no committee involvement. The tax cut bill was written in secret, no committee involvement. And my experience in legislative bodies from the state Senate in Vermont, where it's open and where the minority has a significant role. So what we have been proposing are changes in our rules and procedures to give much more power to the committees, much more responsibility to the committees. And in fact, we have a draft set of rules that incorporates many of the proposals many of us have made, from the problem solvers to other Democrats who have been concerned about restoring power to the committees and decentralizing it outside of the Speaker's office. So that's been very productive.
So do you think that Nancy Pelosi will be supportive of those reform efforts?
Well, she is. And, you know, I think it's been a very good situation because we, the members, have had an opportunity to assert the changes that we want in order to make the committee's effective. And if I see anything where there's common ground from the people who were Pelosi advocates to the never Pelosi advocates, it's that they all share my concern about restoring power and responsibility to the committees. It's the only way the Congress has a chance of doing legitimate things on behalf of the American people. So that time that we've taken, where we've postponed the leadership elections and focused on what are the rules by which we're going to operate? How do we open up the committee process? How do we guarantee that there'll be amendments? How do we make certain that any bill that's going to come out has to actually have a committee hearing in a markup? That means it's done in the open as opposed to in secret in the Speaker's office. Frankly, I think that's going to be beneficial to our Republican colleagues to have at least a fair shot, which we didn't have, to make their case in a committee on their particular point of view.
So if Nancy Pelosi supports your reform efforts, sounds like you're going to vote for her.
Well, we'll see. Right now, she's the only one who's running, and we're still in the negotiation process on these process reforms. And it's really been helpful to us that we didn't rush pell-mell into the election, that, you know, the day for leadership the day after the election, because there's been just an enormous amount of input and, like, I think a coalescence around the proposition that whoever wants to run for leader, if someone comes forward and wants to challenge Pelosi, and that hasn't happened yet, they've got to deal with the fact that there's been a very clear expression from the majority of the caucus that we want to have an open process, we want to have amendments, we don't want to have these closed rules, and where there's bipartisan legislation and you want to use a discharge petition, that's going to come onto the floor within 3 days. So these are all things that I think are really helpful and have to be embraced by Pelosi or whoever it is that may emerge as a challenge to her. That person's going to have to embrace them as well.
Congressman, I read this morning that Ohio Representative Marsha Fudge is definitely thinking about getting into this race. How would that change things?
Not clear. You know, she's a last-minute candidate, so there's been no outreach from her that I'm really aware of. She's a good colleague, trusted colleague, and a very good person. But she's one of the people that signed the letter saying that she would never, ever vote for Pelosi. But she's done no outreach whatsoever and not begun a campaign. But what it does show is that there's real potential contest here. But whether that will merge into a real contest, we don't know.
Congressman, we got this email from Chris in Washington, Vermont. I urge you not to support Nancy Pelosi for speaker. It's time for new leadership for the party, and Pelosi is the embodiment of an elite, corrupt, tone-deaf politician whom the Republicans have used for years to smear Democratic candidates. It's no wonder that Trump has endorsed her. He realizes that she's the perfect foil to run against in 2020.
Well, and I hear that from people. I mean, my view is this. First of all, let's acknowledge something. Nancy Pelosi's done an incredible job. I mean, I've served in legislative bodies in Vermont and in Congress, and she's an extremely effective legislator who not only works hard, but has, what, from my perspective, very progressive values. This, with respect to what that caller says, there is a big mood that we need change. And I think that's true, and I think our party has to move to start doing transitioning to change, because I think that we have to have the capacity ultimately to reach out to middle America. A lot of the folks who voted for President Trump have legitimate grievance because they've been left behind economically. But I do think that the big issue for us in Congress is to start focusing on practical legislation that makes a difference for middle-class people. And I think that issue of who's going to be our spokesperson is going to be much more a function of who's our presidential candidate. And that presidential campaign, of course, is going to really accelerate now that this election is behind us. And that spokesperson role that individual is rightly concerned about, I think, is going to be much more the burden of whoever emerges as the Democratic candidate for president.
Would it be fair to say you're leaning towards supporting her?
It's fair to say that I'll vote for the Democrat, and she's the only Democrat who's in the race. And it's also fair to say that the reality of us being able to do constructive things on behalf of the middle class is going to depend on the changes we make and how our committees operate. And that's something I see because I'm on the inside. It's something I saw when I was at the State House in Montpelier, where you have an open process where there's actually an opportunity for the minority to participate. My experience, that produces durable legislation. And that's my goal. My job to represent Vermont is to not only advocate for things that are good for Vermont, but is to do everything I can with this position that Vermonters have given me for two more years to make this broken institution work. That's my responsibility. So that, what do we do to make that happen? Is it all about Pelosi? In fact, it's not all about Pelosi. It's about each and every one of us getting on an agenda and having rules that allow for the fair consideration of things that are going to help the middle class.
Congressman, you're in what is known now as the lame duck session. In the next 4 weeks, you'll consider a number of important bills, and sort of looming in the background is the threat of a government shutdown when the current budget agreement ends on December 7th. And one key piece of that may be that President Trump wants $5 billion as a down payment for his wall along the Mexican border. Will you support that plan?
No, I won't. Let me step back for a second. With all the controversy in this Congress and all the fighting that we've had, the appropriators, Republican and Democrat, have actually done, in my view, a pretty good job. And they've come to an agreement that allows us to maintain funding for the government. And it is a budget, by the way, that is far better for Vermont than the one that was proposed by President Trump, where we would have cut our nutrition programs, Meals on Wheels, where our environmental programs would be dramatically cut. So the Republicans and Democrats on the Budget Committee have done a good job, and they're ready to reach an agreement. The president is doing what he's consistently done every time we've been at one of these choke points. He said he's introduced his wall politics, his immigration politics into the agenda. And so none of us know what the president's going to do and whether he's going to be the person promoting a shutdown unless he gets his way. My hope is he won't. Senator McConnell, who's no friend of mine, leader of the Senate, is saying we're not going to have a shutdown. That's just bad for the country. It's bad for everyone. The wall funding really should be put in the context of our Homeland Security bill and what we need to do to have border security. And everybody who's looked at this, including Republicans who live in Texas and are very, very strong in border security, say spending $35 billion for a wall from sea to shining sea is way more money and way less effective than if we have a sector-by-sector approach to border security. In some places, that would include a physical barrier or a wall. In other places, it would be perhaps technology. In other places, it might be more personnel along the border. So the border security issue is really not in dispute. Republicans and Democrats acknowledge that to the extent the president is concerned about border security, we are too. But the wall is a metaphor for the president, basically, to demand his way, and then the threat of a shutdown is something a president, in my view, should be the last person to be advocating. Shutdown politics, debt default politics, generally it's the executive who is the adult supervision in the room, and you get a Freedom Caucus, a group of legislators who are willing to burn the house down to get their way on an extraneous issue. So it's disturbing to me that the president continues basically to play shutdown politics.
Congressman, we got this email from Jane who wrote, "I'm distressed to hear that Representative Welch is considering giving Trump some financial support for his wall on our southern border. Of all the issues on which Congress might consider compromising with the president, this wall is one of the lapsed options. How about this for a compromise? U.S. taxpayers will match dollar for dollar every contribution that Mexico makes to building the wall. If there was ever a time to hold Trump to a promise, it's this one. Mexico will pay for the wall." So what do you say to those folks who think it's a mistake even to allocate $1 billion or $1.6 billion for the wall?
Well, first of all, I like the point that that caller writer made. I mean, yes, Mr. President, let's have you say Mexico's going to pay for the wall. Show us the money. I really do like that. And why shouldn't the president have to live up to that promise? The issue, here's the issue. There's two things. One is the border security. And we do have to have secure borders. And as you know, I went down to the border. Let me come back to that. But we have to have border security. But what we really need is a comprehensive immigration reform bill. And border security is part of that. But it should also be a path to citizenship. It also should be legal status for our dreamers. It should also be how do we help our farmers who need immigrant labor in order to milk the cows. So the caller, I think, is expressing a concern that I share, that we've got to treat the people who are here with dignity. We have to have more legal options for people who want to immigrate to have an opportunity to apply and come here legally. I want to do all of those things. And what I'm appalled at, and I've seen this with Vermonters everywhere, is what the president is doing in our name that I find absolutely outrageous, separating children from their parents. And that is so shocking that it's done with the authority of the government that all of us supposedly are represented by. And when I made that trip down to the border, and I met with these women, it was like around midnight. It was the Senator Berkeley, and there were 10 women who had a similar story, that they literally, in the middle of the night, got their child up and said, we have got to leave, because their boyfriend or their husband had been killed, their daughter had been threatened with rape. And they made this incredible march from Central America to the bridge in Brownsville and knocked on our door and asked for help. And the president's policy not only made that a crime, it said, we're taking your kid. And by the way, 500 of those children are still not connected to their parents. So this is what I find so awful about the president's approach on immigration reform. Sure, we need a wall. We do. We don't need a wall. We need border security. But we need a comprehensive immigration plan is what we need, that is protective of all the issues of enormous concern.
Today in the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Let's turn to our listeners and talk to David, who's calling from Brattleboro. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask the representative if he would support Speaker Pelosi if she continues to resist supporting Medicare for all. Representative Hoyer just reaffirmed that position this morning on the radio, and I was pretty shocked to hear it. And since he's a member of the Medicare for All caucus, I would think that he would not support her if she doesn't change that tune.
Well, I do support Medicare for All, as you know, and I support bringing down the cost of prescription drugs. But as far as who I support for Speaker, whether it's a litmus test on any issue, I tend not to do that. In my experience, Leader Pelosi, when it comes to health care, is incredibly supportive. We wouldn't have had the Affordable Care Act passed without her. So having that as a litmus test is something I tend to shy away from. And on the question of health care, as I mentioned, she's been pretty solid on that. But my hope is that we'll have an opportunity to really move ahead on Medicare for All. But we also have to make real whatever progress we can, like bring down the cost of prescription drugs.
Let's talk to John in Stratford. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Thank you. A modest suggestion is I would say Peter would be an ideal transitional leadership for Speaker of the House himself. You know, he has the legislative experience. He has the ability to work with others. He has the progressive policies. He has the ability to keep his eye on the prize and make real progress and speak well to all Americans. And if not, and if you don't choose to put your hat in the ring for Speaker of the House, Peter, I would really urge the Democrats to take advantage of your considerable abilities and eloquence and ability to get to the harder things and have you in a leadership position. Thanks.
Well, thank you, John. Congressman, let's just play this scenario out that the people who oppose Nancy Pelosi have the votes to stop her. She can't get 218 votes on the House floor at the beginning of January, and everything is kind of thrown into turmoil. Is there any possibility, you've been in leadership positions down there and you've worked with the Republicans, is there any possibility, as John suggested, that running for Speaker might be in your future?
No, I don't really think it is. But here's the heart of what he said that I think makes a lot of sense, and it's the struggle that we're having down here. The Democratic Party has to make a transition. It's not just about Nancy Pelosi. And the House of Representatives has to make a transition, and it's not just about who our leadership it is. We have to acknowledge that as much as this economy has been booming, there are Americans who've been working hard for the past 20 years that really haven't had a raise. We have to acknowledge that the healthcare system, with all the benefits of Obamacare, with expanded access and expanded Medicaid, is too expensive. People can't afford the copays and the deductibles, and you see that most acutely in pharma. We have to acknowledge that the threat of climate change is not a threat anymore. It's a reality. The house is burning down. Look at those wildfires in California. And we have to acknowledge that the flood of outside dark money is starting to cause real cancer in our democracy. And that is what I'm hearing from people. They want this institution and their political leaders to be responsive to that and acknowledge it. And us, and that's what I think this vote was about. This is a critical vote across the country. Every 2 years, the Constitution gives the American people the opportunity to tell the president they want a mid-course correction. And that's the message from this election. Down here, my view is that the Democrats were in the majority in the House. But this was a vote about Trump. It wasn't a vote in favor of us. And now we have the opportunity with the majority to earn the trust of the people who made us the majority. And my view is a lot of the comments people are making really make sense. But what we have to do here, frankly, is do it the way we do it in Vermont. We have to have a focus on issues that make a difference to the pocketbook of everyday Americans. And we have to have a process where we make a genuine effort to do things that are going to be beneficial to folks in red states as well as blue states. Like, for instance, we bring carbon emissions down. That's good for Trump voters in Oklahoma. We bring pharma price, the prescription drug prices down. It's good for folks in Kansas who voted for Trump, just as it is for Vermonters who voted for Hillary. These are things that give us an opportunity to create some unity if we try to attack problems that are causing pain across this country for Republicans and Democrats. And I want us to get to work on doing that. And that's got to be a collective decision by me and my Democratic colleagues here. And that's been the focus of my attention is in this transition period. What's our agenda and how are we going to operate?
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch, talking about issues in the lame duck session. I just had this last thought, Congressman, about this House Speaker's race. I learned this week, maybe this is common knowledge, I didn't know it, you don't have to be a member of the House to be Speaker.
That's right.
Can you see any circumstances where if Nancy Pelosi is blocked from becoming the next speaker, that the House Democratic Caucus would go outside of the chamber and select somebody?
I don't, even though that is a possibility and some people float it as an idea. But I don't. These things don't happen out of nowhere. I mean, if Pelosi didn't get the votes that she needed and we had second and third ballots, then anything could happen. But my expectation is that whoever did emerge would be a member of the House.
Let's look at some other bills that you're watching during this lame duck session. How about legislation that would protect the future of Special Prosecutor, Special Counsel Robert Mueller, to maybe be part of the final budget bill? Is that likely to happen?
There's a shot it will happen. That's my legislation in the House, and there's, of course, Senator Leahy is promoting that in the Senate as well. And we're getting some more support for that. Another is Senator Grassley is the chair of the Judiciary Committee, who previously was against it, is now saying that he's for acting on that. And there's more concern about protecting the Mueller investigation as a result of the appointment of this new attorney general, who before his appointment spoke with great hostility about the government role and about the Mueller investigation. And I think that the biggest protection that the Mueller investigation got was the verdict of the American people. I mean, they voted, and their vote by sending a House Democratic majority clearly is the best protection we can have. But I would like the legislation that makes it impossible for the president to fire the special prosecutor unless there's a cause and without the approval of a court. I would very much like to see that part of the final package.
Now, yesterday, we heard Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell say that he's not going to support that legislation because there's no need for the bill. Senator McConnell says nothing is going to happen to Mr. Mueller. Therefore, we don't need legislation.
Well, there's a lot of folks that don't have his confidence. I mean, Senator McConnell just won't act. The president has been explicitly hostile to the Mueller investigation. He's constantly calling it a witch hunt. Mueller, fortunately, is a person who has such high regard as he's a Republican, but as a person who calls it the way he sees it and does his job carefully, there's been no press leaks. The benefit of having the investigation is that it provides assurance in the form of a law as opposed to just the wishful thinking of Senator McConnell. And keep in mind, Senator Flake is very much in favor of this legislation as well. So why not give the American people and the Mueller committee peace of mind that would be provided by passage of this protection legislation rather than have them be subject to the whims of the president?
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Tim, who's calling from Springfield. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I was trying to get a hold of all the congressional delegates from Vermont when Trump said the things about the poop hole countries. And all the things that he said that are just lack compassion are just beyond the norm, that I felt like our whole congressional delegate should have spoken up on the floor, that we're normalizing things he's saying about the migrants, things he's saying about other countries. And politics aside, I think we... you have to take a chance and make a moral stand when he says things like that or becomes normal. I heard that historically that things changed with Reconstruction to Jim Crow law when the Republicans would no longer... When Southern Democrats were making the charge that they were, to put it in better words, black people lovers, they said, no, we're not. And it became possible for the Jim Crow laws to pass because they didn't make a strong stand. And
Tim, thank you very much for your comment. I think we got to have an idea of where you're coming from. Congressman Welch, Tim, obviously concerned that somehow the president's thoughts are detrimental and that we'll be normalizing that. What are your thoughts about that?
Tim is 100% right. That's what's appalling about this president. The job of a president, first and foremost, Republican or Democrat, is to help bring us together as a country. It's not to be creating division on the basis of your race or your religion. You know, the Muslim ban that the president did was terrible. This border separation policy, taking kids from parents, is terrible. What he says about Hispanics is terrible, and about women. And so Tim is right about that. And that is what I think I found of most concern to most Vermonters. It's like the guardrails of democracy are coming down. So I think Tim is right. On the question of us speaking out, I mean, Patrick has, and I've seen him and heard him. Bernie certainly has. I've seen him and heard him, and I've been on the floor. So I'm doing it, even if it doesn't get as much attention as Tim thinks he'd like it to have. And Governor Scott has been critical of some of the conduct of the president. So Vermonters really don't appreciate and worry about the implication of the president trashing people on the basis of their race, their religion. It's really, really terrible.
So on along these lines, we got this email from Dave who wrote us last month. Congressman Welch said this: I think the big issue for us right now is preserving our democracy. I think the guardrails of democracy are under assault and that the president is being too cozy, in my view, with dictators. Then after the election, this is Dave writing, Congressman Welch wants to avoid partisan investigations. Seems like he must have an evil twin. What was he talking about when he attacked the president last month, and what is he talking about now?
Well, what I said about the president then, I'd repeat right now. Those are my concerns. My question on the investigations and the impeachment is two things. Number one, on the whole question of impeachment, we have a process with Mueller that's independent and that has political credibility. In my view, is that we want to protect its independence, and then when the report is provided, we're all going to have to make our decisions about what should happen. Third, on the question of investigations, we're going to do those. I'm on the oversight committee, and we'll be doing investigations. But I believe that it's really important for us to show by how we proceed that we want to do things that are going to make a difference to people who are paying way too much for health care and pharmaceutical drugs, that we're taking steps to bring down carbon emissions, that we're trying to do something to make college more affordable. And job training more available to all these kids who are trying to make their way in life. So my emphasis here is that we have to focus on the economic concerns that the struggling middle class are facing, and we have to do our investigations, but we can't just be the revenge party. I want us to be the accomplishment party, to start changing the way we proceed.
Do you anticipate or do you want to be on the House Oversight Committee in the new Congress?
I anticipate I will be. You know, I'm on two committees now and have been, the Energy and Commerce Committee, which is considered to be a top committee in the Congress. And I've been on the Oversight Committee for all the time I've been in Congress, 12 years. I have to serve on that with a waiver because under the House rules, if you're on the top, one of the top committees, Energy and Commerce, that's, for most members, the only committee they'd be on. But I've had two all the time I've been here. I'm very close to Elijah Cummings. That committee is going to have a lot to do with prescription drug price negotiation and oversight, the topic that the earlier writer or caller was mentioning.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Let's turn to Paula, who is calling from Enosburg Falls. Hi, Paula. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I really appreciate Representative Welch's comments on pocketbook issues being important. And what I would love to see as a strategy to have the House Democrats jump right into the popular issue that they ran on, and that's health care, both prescription drug reform and protecting the coverage of existing conditions. These are both things that Trump and the Republicans have said they support, and I think you should call their bluff and put out a bill allowing the government to negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceuticals, and put out a bill guaranteeing coverage of pre-existing conditions without allowing premium prices to skyrocket. So that's what I'd like to see happen right early on.
Well, I agree with you. I totally agree with you on it. And, I want to go back to one of the reasons I think it's so important to focus on those pocketbook issues. They affect everybody. You know, there's so much division in our country, and there shouldn't be. You should not be dividing people because of their religion or their race or their gender. But we all have challenges when it comes to paying for prescription drugs. And that's not a red or blue kind of thing. And if we reach out and try to do things like that, like extend broadband into rural Vermont and rural Oklahoma and rural Texas, we have a chance of working together. We'll have our differences, but at least we'll be trying to do things that are beneficial to all concerned. So healthcare is what I hear about almost more than anything else. You've got to have healthcare, and we've got a system where more people have access, but it's still way too expensive. The pharmaceutical companies on pricing have been ripping us off badly, and you're right. The president said to me and Elijah Cummings when we met with him a year ago, April, that we've got to bring those prices down, and let's see if they act.
Congressman, I'm wondering, let's say the House does go through and pass some of these health care reform initiatives that you're talking about that Paula was interested in. Isn't the political reality that these initiatives are going to be rejected by the Republican majority in the Senate? And so what we're really looking at is 2 years of gridlock.
Well, that's my fear, and it's a fear that you rightly bring up. But here's my view on how we in the House have to approach it. We have the majority, so we have the opportunity to put good legislation on the floor. My view is that we should make a real effort. Let's just take prescription drugs as an example, to reach out to some individual Republicans who will support us on that. Like Francis Rooney is he's a Republican from Florida. And he's a co-sponsor of my price negotiation bill. My view is that if we pass that out of the House and it has 15, 20, 25 Republican votes with us, that's much more difficult for the Senate to resist and just dismiss. And in fact, it makes it somewhat more appealing perhaps for the president to get behind. So it's a question for us in the House, what do we do? And I want to do these pocketbook issues. But it's also a question of how do we do it? Do we make a genuine effort in order to achieve our goal to find ways to get Republican support? And I know on some of these things, like broadband, like prescription drugs, that's hammering rural America and Trump voting districts just as much as it's hurting us in Vermont. So the gridlock is a potential. I can't control what's going to happen in the Senate. Bernie and Patrick will be over there fighting tooth and nail for us, but Mitch McConnell's in charge. But if we get that over with some bipartisan support, we have a better shot. And it then becomes a foundation for the campaign for president in 2020.
Let's talk to Patricia, who is calling from Brownington. Hi, Patricia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for letting me call. I agree with all that's been going on regarding health care, prescription drugs, and all. But my question is that it's my understanding that we had a 17% increase in our national debt last year, and the corporation paid 30% less. What are we going to do about the debt? I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, you're right, and I'm really glad you brought that up. And you know where most of that came from. It was $2.3 trillion added to the debt as a result of that outrageous tax cut. You know, that tax cut largely went to corporations. The promise was they were going to reinvest. Basically, they've been using that money to buy back stock that further enhances the benefit to the top 1% and doesn't result in the investment that we need. And in fact, the week after they passed that tax cut and added to the national debt, then Senator McConnell, when asked about the infrastructure program that both Republicans and Democrats wanted to pursue, he said there's not enough money. Now, the House rules that we're now discussing are going to restore something that I think is important, pay-as-you-go. You know, as much as I support a lot of programs, I do believe we have to pay for those. We have to find a way to either pay for it with revenues or we have to find a way to offset some of the costs. So the rules that we're going to be considering will implement some fiscal responsibility that has been completely absent the last several years.
Congressman, could you see the new Democratic majority in 2019 trying to reverse some of the provisions of that tax cut bill?
Well, I hope we do on some of them. You know, I just think that this, for instance, I'll give an example, carried interest, you know, where the hedge fund executives, people who literally make $1 billion, they get to treat all their income as though it's capital gains, and they pay at a lower rate than their chauffeur or the secretary who works there. I mean, Warren Buffett decried that. So that's an example of something in that tax law that I think is absolutely outrageous, and I would be for repealing it right away.
How about the provisions that deal with corporations and also wealthier Americans?
Yeah, well, we need changes in the corporate tax rate. This is going to be very, 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 very difficult because this is where the gridlock that you spoke about earlier in the Senate, whatever we pass in the House would have very, very tough sledding in the Senate and with the president. But I do believe that what happened with the focus on the corporate tax rate, there's a legitimate issue there, but it went amok because the rate went way down so much that the corporations are paying way less than they have been paying historically, and it's resulted in addition to the deficit, the money hasn't gone into reinvestment in improving our economy. So ideally, we'd have a comprehensive tax reform that there's been a consensus that we do need to make changes, but it was going to be revenue neutral when we lost that. But I don't see the prospects for comprehensive tax reform in this divided Congress.
Let's talk to John, calling from Burlington. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Lobby reform. This seems to be the basis of much of our problems. You know, each party blames the other party for taking money from this group or taking money from that group. We've been complaining about this for decades, but we don't see any lobby reform. So what I'd like to know is, do you feel that this will ever happen?
John, let me ask you a question just so we can clarify this. When you talk about the need to have lobbying reform, are you really talking about the need to have campaign finance reform?
Campaign finance reform as well as lobbying reform, because a lot of these major companies, pharmaceutical being one of them, are lobbying different senators, congressmen, or congresspersons to to basically fall in line with what they need, and they're doing it through back channel ways and funneling money. And, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything, but this is happening. And that's how, you know, these different Congress people are getting both elected. Yes, campaign finance reform, but there are other ways as well. So,
okay, thank you, John, for clarifying that. Congressman?
One of the first things we're going to be voting on is reform, is campaign finance reform, because the caller makes a really good point. And he is correct as well that this place is flooded with lobbyists. I mean, there's like four pharmaceutical lobbyists for every member of Congress, and the amount they spend on direct lobbying is immense. But there is a challenge to us that we have in this country, and it's called Citizens United, because that decision by the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, said corporations or wealthy individuals can spend whatever they want and they don't have to disclose it. And it has resulted in this vast flood of money that is coming into campaigns. You know, two years ago, there was about $1.8 billion spent. $1 billion of that was contributed by 100 wealthy Americans. This election, it was about $5 billion. And what's happened is that it means folks with an enormous amount of money are, in many ways, hijacking the political process. You know, when I first ran for Congress, it was 2006. It was a very, very good, very, very good opponent, Martha Rainville. And she and I sat down and had a cup of coffee, and we agreed we didn't want to run negative ads. And we had a handshake, and neither of us ran a single negative ad. That's the last time a contested congressional race had no negative advertising. What happened after that? Citizens United, all this outside money comes in, and we couldn't make that agreement today.
So we're almost out of time, but I'm fascinated to know, what do you think you can do on campaign finance reform given the Citizens United decision?
One is public disclosure. It's all dark money now, so when these super PACs get money, they don't have to acknowledge who their donors are. Every dollar that anybody running for Congress gets in their campaign account, we have to disclose where it came from, how much it was, and we have to disclose how we spent it. We'd have the opportunity to expand voting rights, which I think are being attacked in many parts of the country. We'd be able to require the disclosure of contributors to the super PACs and how that money got spent. We'd be able to challenge the gerrymandering that has been very pernicious in our country by requiring congressional districts to be written not by the politicians but by independent commissions. So these are some of the things that there's a lot of support for us to do that would make a difference. It wouldn't overturn Citizens United, which is ultimately what we have to do, but it would make a difference.
We'll be following many of these issues in the lame duck session and also in the session that begins in 2019. Many thanks to our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Many thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.